You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 297 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Amazing to think that we're just three away from that mythical 300 figure of podcasts broadcast out there across the ether to all of you out there. And this, none of this would have been possible without the listeners tuning in, you listeners tuning in, week out, and giving feedback and providing ideas on who you would like to hear on this show. And with that in mind, of course, he was recommended to me to get Adam Isaacson of the Washington Office of Latin America on the show, and we fulfilled that promise, as on this episode 297, Adam Isaacson joins us here in Bogota to talk about Colombia and the region from his vantage point as the director of WOLA in Washington, D.C. The elections are over. The election fever is past. I'm not going to dwell too much on this. I'll leave that to Adrian Alsema in segment two, the news segment from Columbia Reports based in Medellin. I'm sure he'll have some interesting insights as to what is going on in Colombia and what has happened, but I'll leave that to Adrian. And in segment three, we'll be back with Adam Isaacson telling us a little bit about what he's been doing in Colombia and, of course, what he feels is going on in Colombia at the moment. Fantastic interview with one of the most foremost Latin Americanists around. So definitely one to tune into. And I'm going to leave you now in the capable hands of Adrian Alsema and Columbia Reports to give you a breakdown of the Sunday night elections in Colombia. So thank you again, and don't go away.
My name is Adrian Alsema, and this is the news for Columbia Calling for October 29, 2019. The ruling Democratic Center Party received an electoral beating in Sunday's local elections. The far-right party of President Ivan Duque and former President Álvaro Uribe was even defeated in Medellin, the stomping ground of the Uribistas. The local elections are generally seen as a barometer for the next general elections that are held in 2022. Uribe admitted his defeat on Twitter, saying he received the results with humility. The former president has hinted he would resign at the end of his term in 2022 if he is not in prison by then. Because his party lost almost all its regional power networks, it's uncertain if the CD will be of any relevance in the next elections. The biggest landslides took place in the capital Bogota and in Medellin, Colombia's second largest city. The capital elected Claudia Lopez, its first female and openly gay mayor. Medellin elected anti-corruption candidate Daniel Quintero, who defeated one of the most powerful and controversial dynasties in the Antioquia province. Former FARC troubadour Guillermo Torres became the guerrilla's first elected mayor since their demobilization in 2017. Torres won the elections in the northern town of Turbaco in a landslide victory. President Ivan Duque announced increased security at all FARC reintegration sites after the assassination of one of the former guerrilla's reintegration chiefs. Alexander Parra coordinated the reintegration of hundreds of former guerrillas in the central Meta province. His assassination is particularly sensitive because he personally met with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and Norwegian Prince Haakon. A court in Belgium began the trial against a Venezuelan activist who admittedly took part in Colombian intelligence operations. Patricia Betancourt allegedly slandered NGOs as part of Operation Europe. This operation of former intelligence agency DAS sought to discredit and wiretap organizations critical of former President Alvaro Uribe. More than 36% of the population of the northwestern Chocó province has been victimized by armed conflict so far this year, according to the United Nations. The rural population of this province has been caught in the crossfire between several armed conflicts. ELN guerrillas, the military, AGC paramilitaries, and FARC dissidents are vying for control over the province on the Pacific coast. That's the end of this week's News Bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is segment 3 of the Colombia Calling podcast, episode 297. And my very special guest this week is Adam Isaacson. Those of you who are Colombianists or indeed know anything about the Americas will know Adam's name. He's the Director for Defense Oversight of WOLA. That's the Washington Office on Latin America. So it's the guys who actually really put together, a watchdog, I would say, about what's going on in U.S. interests in Latin America. It's not for me to describe what he does. It's for Adam to describe what he does. And so welcome on Colombia Calling.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's great to put a face on the name. We just met for the first time, although I feel I know you. What does WOLA do? I have trouble explaining what I do to my parents in this job. But WOLA was founded in 1974 by some folks who were sort of lay workers in Chile. They were Americans. They were religious workers. They were there for the coup. And they were shocked by the U.S. response to it and found out, of course, about the U.S. responsibility for it, and decided that there was a need for a presence in Washington of people who were going to work for human rights and U.S. policy toward Latin America. And obviously, it's evolved a lot over 40-some years. We are not, a religious organization anymore. We have a lot of programs. Mine is called Defense Oversight, because I guess what I've done both at WOLA and at the place called the Center for International Policy before that, since the 90s, I got fascinated even in college about the idea that the United States put such a priority on working with militaries, almost above diplomats and others, all over Latin America. Central America was what sort of formed me in high school and stuff, because Reagan was working quite assiduously to aid militaries there at the time. And I got so interested in it and just stayed with it. What we did in the 90s as the World Wide Web started to become created was create a online database of everything we could find about arms transfers, training programs, where are the bases, where are the exercises, what is Southcom doing? And that involved getting to know the Pentagon, getting to know the right committees in Congress, and just building up this big database, which we called for a long time just the facts, because we were very bad at titles. Sound like an abortion website or something. Just the facts. But it still exists today at the Center for International Policy. It's called securityassistance.org, where you can get all the numbers going back to the mid-90s of what we were giving and what the aid was made up of, what we were training people in. And so that continued. But as a result of that work, by the late 90s, it was very clear that one country was doubling in aid every year, roughly. Just in the run-up to Plan Colombia, as things here in Colombia were quite a mess, we were like, what? None of us really knew Colombia. There were a couple of groups that had, some presence here. But by 97, 98, it was like, we have to make this a focus of our work. And by us, I mean sort of the human rights community in Washington. And a few of us traveled here for the first time in January of 1998. The director of WOLA was on that trip, although I didn't work on WOLA at that time. The director of the Latin America Working Group and a few other groups. And we went to, all around Bogota and Guaviare, and where the spray program was going on only then at the time. And since then, I've never lived here. I've never been here for more than a month at a time, but I've been here about 80 times over all of those years, and mainly going to the parts of the country where the U.S. military aid is getting spent to talk to people on the receiving end. So it's been quite a ride. It's like a telenovela that never really ends.
That's what, unfortunately, life feels like a lot here, the telenovela that never ends.
Right.
But you spread your time. Colombia is a main focus, but let's think about, this last couple of weeks in Latin America. Bolivian elections, Ecuadorian unrest, Chilean unrest. The problems here in Colombia, Guatemalan elections. You're working on border programs, Mexico, U.S.
It's a neighborhood of houses that are on fire. But yeah, I mean, it's a real bandwidth issue for us at WOLA, as you can imagine. You know, especially when some of the fires that are being, you know, burning right now are being started by our own administration. Yeah, in 2011 at WOLA, we did decide to focus more on border security because there were some human rights issues that were not going away at the border, even then, which was a time of lower migration. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, President Trump has made that more of a focus. So, about half the time I'm at the, you know, covering the U.S.-Mexico border, or, you know, in August we spent just over a week at the Mexico-Guatemala border. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very schizophrenic effort.
There, that border area. That's
we were there in, you know, Ciudad Hidalgo. We went all the way up to Tenosique, and of course that was in the wake of, remember, President Trump threatened tariffs, and then Mexico cracked down in response, and then we saw, you know, the results of that crackdown. We've got a report about that that is in the latter stages. It should be out soon. But yeah, so it's, I guess I should define my work now as the U.S. relationship with everybody who wears a uniform and carries a gun in Latin America, more than just military assistance.
How many people work in your outfit? Because this is a huge area to cover.
Yeah, I mean, luckily we've grown a lot. I think, you know, maybe President Trump has helped with that a little bit. We now have between 25 and 30 people. We have, you know, six or seven pretty active programs now. Mm-hmm. You know, covering, you know, Colombia, Venezuela, great program in Venezuela. Great. If you can get Jeff Ramsey or David Smildy to come talk to you, that'd be great.
Love it.
And they're through here sometimes. You know, the program on Cuba, program on Mexico, mm-hmm. and then our border program, and a drug policy program that's been very active, and one on citizen security in Central America. And it's great being in a room. You know, you get, you know, nobody loves a staff meeting, but it is great sitting down on Monday morning with people who are doing their best work all around the region. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness, yeah, I mean, funding has, knock on wood, right? But funding has not been too much of an issue because of the urgency of what's going on.
And the funding is all, it's private donors, it's not government-related, it's independent.
Yeah, nothing from the U.S. government. Okay. We do get some support from a couple of European governments for specific programs, mm-hmm. but the rest is, yeah, it's all foundations. And now we're up to about 40% individual donors.
Wow.
So, WOLA.org/donate.
Fair enough. Fair enough. You're out there. I can't promise you an upturn in your donation.
Maybe a little bit helps.
throw a dollar.
That's right.
But this is, I mean, it's amazing. Now, before we jump into Colombia, because there's just too many things I'd like to ask you, just based on my own background. I mean, I lived in Guatemala in 98, 99.
Right after the peace accord.
Yeah. And now it's a secure second country? Is that they're going to be processing people in Guatemala?
Well, I mean, this has to go through, you know, Guatemala's Congress, and we'll see what happens. But the deal is that, yeah, people who are from countries other than Guatemala would be required to seek asylum in Guatemala. And if they're picked up by Border Patrol on U.S. soil, they could, if they're Honduran or Salvadoran especially, they could be sent to Guatemala to go apply for asylum there, which... Yeah, I mean, there will be many legal challenges to this before it even happens.
Okay.
But it's hard to imagine Guatemala ever accommodating more than maybe 1,000 people anyway. But it is. It shows you what the Trump administration and Stephen Miller's thinking looks like.
Well, I mean, my getting my head around is they're not thinking.
There's similar agreements with Salvador and Honduras now, too. So Cubans who come up that way, or Chinese or Indians, people who come up through those traditional migration routes could actually be sent back to San Salvador to go, you know, go ask for asylum there. You should have gone there first.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. As you say, Guatemala doesn't have the capabilities.
I think they might have an asylum office, but it has one or two employees.
It must be near to where I had to reapply for a visa in a chaotic part of
Guate. Sure.
I just remember.
In Zona 1 somewhere?
Yeah, something like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, he's not here. He's having lunch. Oh, okay. that kind of thing. Fair enough. Uh-huh. But your work in Colombia, I mean, you're back and forth here, but you've just been in Arauca and the Chocó.
Right.
One thing that jumps out at me at this moment, and I know you, obviously every region is different and every country is different, they must end up getting blurred after a while when you're, when you're dealing with, you know, gross human rights violations. You're like, oh, I've seen this before. You know?
I guess there's a little of that, although, you know, the characters have changed. But, I mean, you know, you've got the same gross inequality. You've got the same small regional elites that will stoop to every possible low level to, you know, using violence to maintain themselves where they are. You've got the same corruption. You've got, you know, the same, you know, mixed bag of security forces, let's put it that way. Some who have a better idea of what their job is and others who are clearly, you know, a big part of the problem. You know, and you've got, you know, a mixture of USAID programs, some of them well-meaning and actually functioning. You know, USAID actually has gotten pretty good in some of what they do here. But then, you know, a military perspective that sometimes looks at institutional reform, but sometimes is just looking at helping the Colombians, you know, rack up their body counts or other measures of success.
Yeah.
Arauca and Chocó lately, I mean, are not... You know, if you're looking at like the first tier, what are the most dangerous or the most not dangerous, but the biggest security emergencies in the region? You're probably looking more at Catatumbo, the Bajo Cauca region of Antioquia, maybe Tumaco, although that's calmed down, Northern Cauca. Mm. But so we went to places that are sort of second or third tier right now. I mean, both of them are seeing. Both regions we went to are both seeing gradually increasing violence. That this I heard two things were the same narrative. The first was that boy here. 2016 to 2018 was like we have never felt this kind of peace in recent memory. We could, you know, it was possible to open a business. You could travel at night. You really felt you could breathe freely for a while. And 2019 has seen a real downturn. Still not as bad as it was, but the trend that we are afraid of where it's headed. And in both places, the ELN and the FARC dissidents have a sort of non-aggression pact in place. Formal or not, but it is pretty fragile. I mean, everybody, because both groups, as well as in Chocó, they also have paramilitaries, all three there, are recruiting pretty quickly, mostly recruiting minors, and in Arauca, recruiting a lot of Venezuelans. And so you are on a collision course. This is not an equilibrium that's going to maintain.
And now with, let's say this, I want to put it in inverted commas, the new FARC returning, Márquez and Santrich, I
don't know how much of a factor they are, but
I don't know. I mean, they're acting out of Venezuela, and there's 20 sort of atomized groups around the country that they would control. But then, how are you going to control and command that? And I suppose they're going to end up having to look for financing through the traditional forms of financing, and at the same time, I feel that they're not, you know, they're not the principal concern, but that has been the damage, let's say. On the front page.
Yes, that's what's been getting the media attention and what we've been asked about infinitely.
Yeah.
We'll see. Iván Márquez, Romaña, El Paisa, these old guys, you know, the hardliners, people who certainly know how to make money trafficking coca and stuff like that, but they're sort of superimposing themselves on an already pretty busy criminal landscape in places like Arauca and the rest of the country. The largest, you probably covered this, but the largest FARC dissident group and the ones that really claim to maintain the line of Tiro Fijo and Manojojoy, et cetera, are the 1st, 7th, and 40th fronts down in south-central Colombia, in the Meta Guaviare area. And they are the biggest and strongest. They are certainly the wealthiest of the dissidents. And I've seen no signs at all that they have made any deal at all with Iván Márquez and company.
I don't think they want to.
And the ones in the dissidents in Arauca are clearly an offshoot of that, you know, Gentil Duarte, you know, John Cuarenta, this group. And yeah, so it's, I don't know why they would want to share anything with Iván Márquez and company. So I would keep the focus on actually the existing dissidents more than these new guys.
And because I know I'm having to talk about this new group again, quite a lot. And what I find so interesting about it, for the first time, I think really in recent history, I guess, they're coming to this table, as you say, it's an overcrowded table, but, you know, in an inferior position.
Yeah.
The ELN is more the grupos armados, organizados, the whomever else, paramilitary, they're all more powerful than they are. Mm-hmm. So a very interesting situation, and I think
there's all kinds of rumors of them having meetings with the other groups in Venezuela, but you know, we just don't know.
Well, they've been trying to, let's say the FARC and the ELN have tried to have some sort of agreement between them for 60-odd years, and it's never really flourished, so it's always been kind of chaotic.
In Arauca 10 years ago, I mean, we don't even know how many people died when they fought each other, 1,500, 2,000. So there's a fear of that coming back.
But tell us a little bit then about Arauca, because I really don't know it there. I mean, I know of some people who've been bird watching there, you know, maybe in the 2 years of absolute, joyful peace. But now I think it's a different story.
Yeah, I mean, it's still, yeah, I wouldn't recommend going there to do bird watching. But yeah, Arauca is, you know, you're hard up against the Venezuela border, a couple hundred miles southeast of Cucuta. Mm-hmm. It's a sparsely populated area, about 300,000 people in the entire department. It was settled really for the first time in the 50s and 60s by non-indigenous people, mostly folks from, you know, Santander and coming up from Casanare. Cattle ranching was and is huge there. It was sort of a backwater for a long time. Back in the late 70s, the ELN arrived there. Mm-hmm. The ELN in the 70s were almost entirely decimated by the military, and they retreated to Arauca. Formed the Domingo Lane Front there in 79-80. The FARC came with their 10th Front shortly afterward, which was not a very warlike front. Mm-hmm. And then 83 or so, they struck oil, which changed everything in Arauca. Mm-hmm. Occidental Petroleum and Ecopetrol are there pumping out of the Caño Limón oil field, which has a big pipeline that goes all the way to Coveñas on the Caribbean coast. And when they were building that pipeline, it was a German contractor named Mannesmann, which was building it kilometer by kilometer. And the ELN in particular were just extorting the hell out of them. And this is the 1980s. And Mannesmann is going to the Colombian military, look, you know, you got to protect us. And we're not in the business of protecting oil pipelines. And so they had to pay. They paid the ELN at least $10 million, which really paid for the revival of the ELN, which then grew some deep roots in Arauca, Arauquita, Saravena, Tame, where they really have, especially the western half, where they have pretty deep roots in, I don't want to say in civil society writ large, but in some sectors of it, in government. One interesting thing about Arauca right now that the ELN is the dominant power there, this part of the ELN prohibits coca growing. Oh. So Arauca has, you know, probably less than, well under 100 hectares of coca in it.
Wow.
Because they wanted it gone. They think, you know, coca brings an uncontrollable situation. It's also naked capitalism at its worst. And so they prohibited it. The FARC dissidents promoted it, or the FARC promoted it. The FARC dissidents may or may not, we'll see. I don't think that the ELN will let them do it right now. So the ELN made most of its money by extorting the oil industry, getting their piece of oil contracts, and also, you know, having compliant mayors and governors who arranged that they would get bits of money out of the public treasury. And that for a long time was their main source. Now, of course, the Venezuelan border is itself a source. They can pretty much tax almost everything that crosses legally or illegally across that border. So it's not, yes, of course, drugs do transit Arauca, you know, and a lot of, you know, aircraft are not the main way of transporting cocaine these days, but still what does goes out of Apure, on the other side of the border in Venezuela. There's still some cocaine going through Arauca, but it is not probably the main source of revenue for the illegal groups there. Unlike, say, Chocó, where, you know, the Atrato is a cocaine superhighway. In Arauca, not so much. It's interesting.
And what are we were talking Chocó and the Pacific coast a little bit, but you mentioned earlier Tumaco, so it's calming down a bit, but there's always something simmering there.
It's not calming down because the Colombian government has got a handle on the situation. It's calming down because there is, again, some arrangement between the existing groups there. The folks at the Fundación Paz y Reconciliación have done some decent reporting on why Tumaco has suddenly seen a sharp decrease in homicides, and it's just, there's a new equilibrium between the armed groups there. Maybe even, say, some moderated by, you know, Mexican narco traffickers who want to make sure they have a steady supply.
But we do have the footprint, let's say, of the Nuevo Jalisco and Sinaloa cartels in Colombia now, aren't they?
Definitely,
Cauca.
I mean, they want to make sure they have a predictable supply chain. Mm-hmm. I think the departure of the FARC in 2016, 2017 did hurt the predictability. Mm-hmm. And now, yeah, it's funny. I mean, we've gone from, you know, in the 80s, it being the cocaine being in 90s, cocaine being in Colombian hands all the way to U.S. cities to, you know, a few years ago, the cocaine really, for the most part, no longer being in Colombian hands once it left Colombia's coast, to now the Mexicans actually arranging a lot of the supply out of Colombian soil. A real weakening of atomization of Colombian narco trafficking groups at the expense of the Mexicans, who remain pretty consolidated.
It's the whole different equation to try and deal with, and especially when we watch what's happening in Mexico, let's say.
Right.
You know, the tragedy in Culiacan the other day, and you know, this is all connected now.
It really is. And you know, some, you know, if you, what, if you, you know, I think we were talking about this before, like, where might this all be headed? You know, look at, you know, the security think tank folks who try to do maps of who controls what and what, you know, department. And, you know, these maps are increasingly used to just be, this was all FARC and this was all paramilitaries. Now, of course, these maps look like crazy patchworks drawn by an insane person. Like, if you try to show who controls what in Nariño, it's crazy. Go look at a map of Guerrero or Tamaulipas or Michoacan, and you have a similar crazy patchwork map between all these fragments of groups that, you know, who'd ever heard in Mexico of, I mean, Jalisco only is, you know, not that old, but, you know, the Villagras or the Queenies and all these other little groups that are, you know, the factions of the Zetas, and fragmentation is the way of the future right now. And that means you're going to have a lot of fault lines and border lines between these groups that, if nobody's mediating it, are going to mean constant conflict. Not across the entire country, but in a lot of hotspots that are, you know, sort of mini failed states around the region. And that's probably more the future for Colombia. You'll have, I mean, it's present also. Look at Bajo Cauca right now. I mean, whoever heard of the Caparros, and now they're, you know.
Yeah. But this is something that we can expect to increase then. If you're looking at Bajo Cauca, you're looking at pockets and Chocó, Buenaventura, of course.
Right.
I would say then up towards border areas in Norte Santander.
As long as you have no state presence, or the state presence you have is like high impunity for this sort of thing, the most you can hope for is that somebody is there to enforce an arrangement between the groups, or to guarantee that one group has a monopoly. And those are never stable.
No.
But and it's terrible for the people that have to live there, because that's who's really running your life. But you know, but even those people would rather have some predictability than live in a contested area. So, I mean, obviously, we all know the answer is to bring in the entire Colombian state, start with the military if you have to, but quickly bring in the justice system and punish corruption when it happens. But that is way easier said than done, as we've seen.
The Colombian government very good to argue a law in its Congress.
Oh, they make great PowerPoints too for how they're going to get the government into these areas.
But at the end of it, you know, what's on the ground in these areas. And so, I mean, I don't, you know, without being too obvious about it, but the guy we've got in charge, our current president, is not the man who can deliver. I don't know who can deliver on something like this.
You know, on paper, Iván Duque could be the man, because he's, you know, center right. Most Colombians are center right.
Yeah.
He's a technocrat. He's not like a crazy raving populist. And, you know, he's not that far off ideologically from most of the opposition parties in the Congress. Mm-hmm. You'd think he could govern, but he can't, at least not right now, because he's caught between the rest of his party. I mean, when he was a senator, he was by far the most moderate, you know, Centro Democratico senator.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got a real authoritarian populist party, especially his congressional bloc, that keeps him from reaching out to the opposition on things. You know, parties like La U, Cambio Radical, and the liberals, the conservatives, would probably work with him on a lot of things. But he can't do that because his own party would disavow him, and he just doesn't have his own independent political base. Maybe after the, you know, I guess you're going to be hearing this recording after the local elections. We're talking before the local elections, but maybe the local elections will change that calculus and give Duque, you know, if the Centro Democrático receives a real drubbing, then maybe he'll have more latitude to reach out and be more of a consensus person. But his problem, I mean, he's a guy who spent 13 years working at the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, and instead of spending those years building becoming a local political heavyweight here in Colombia.
This is true. He comes from there's a different background to him. It almost feels like he was kept overseas in Washington, being groomed.
My understanding of his story is that, you know, he just was one of these, you know, and Washington's full of these folks who come and work at the beat of the World Bank or something, and they're very happy. Mm. But he helped co-write Uribe's autobiography.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so that is how he got to know Uribe. And then Uribe, I guess, at one point before 2014, said, "Do you want to be a senator?" and
it's the kind of
it worked out for him.
Wields Uribe, the most powerful man in Colombia. But
the fact that Duque became the most recognizable and prominent CD senator in that period is more on Duque than on Uribe, I think.
What are we expecting from the court case, the Supreme Court on Uribe? That was interesting. Behind closed doors, nothing really revealed, but
we know that Iván Cepeda was happy with the outcome.
Yes,
that's about
all we know.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, it still boggles the mind that that Uribe could actually be held accountable in this country. I'm sure it's a legal battle that's going to go on for a long time. But what the court case does, and what especially that you have all of these paramilitaries, in direct contact with Uribe and his lawyers, and the creepiness of Uribe's lawyers, I think that is a gift that's going to keep on giving for a while for Uribe's opponents, because it has hurt his image. It's amazing where Uribe is in the polls now, 35% approval.
Never thought it.
And this will keep happening. It's sort of like the impeachment thing in the United States, that nobody thinks the Senate, Republican Senate, is going to vote out Trump. But hearing after hearing, revelation after revelation, this steady drip is going to keep eroding his popularity.
It has to. This is the thing. The court case, it's just a peculiar situation where you have the sort of pro marches and then the contra marches, and then sort of 20 cats in the Parque Nacional with Paloma Valencia. Does anyone really want to be out there with her? It's kind of scary. I used to live next door in the next building over from one of Uribe's lawyers. And you always knew when something was going on because of all the black cars.
Oh, my God. The armored cars.
It's
a side of Colombia that we really need to shine more of a light on.
I did see a photo of him today with it was Mancuso or Castaño.
Of who? Cadena, the lawyer?
No, De La Espre.
De La Espre, yeah.
With them. These images are all going to keep coming up. And so it's like, oh, God, filthy business.
But the worry is that you're seeing how Colombia really works.
Yeah.
I'm overstating that, but it's a concern. Yeah.
And talking about that, you talk about that briefly, we must mention, that the event at the UN with the photos of context, that was not a great move by whomever it was who put the file together.
It's amazing that this is the same security apparatus that put together, Operación Jaque, that they would actually, have the interns take some photos in and nobody ever did any due diligence. I have to check, if somebody writes something and puts my name on it, I have to check it very carefully. Well, otherwise we can get burned. So that was a very strangely rookie mistake.
And
of course they must have better photos.
You must have it, the ones that can
or the Americans can give them
to Chocó or Cauca or wherever else. Mm-hmm. And having said it was Venezuela and the ELN recruiting children, you're like, come on, if you're gonna throw that at the UN, get it right.
Absolutely.
I kind of think that Duque in that position he should have just done what the president of El Salvador did, the selfie.
Right.
Just do that.
Duque's not as good at the social media as Bukele is.
That's Bukele.
Yeah.
Just do that and everyone's going to laugh and you might even get an upturn in your popularity or something. Because, he's had a miserable ride.
He has.
You mentioned it, but he's had a miserable ride.
And a lot of them are own goals. Yeah.
There's a whole lot of them. And he hasn't even come out with something like, the Santos movement, El Tal Paro. No existence.
Oh, right.
That was amazing.
Right.
I thought that was the biggest own goal that could have been done, but no, Duque, he's pretty good at it, putting his foot in it. But
this tells us he doesn't have a really solid team around him either. Maybe inside the presidency there are a few stars. Well, stars is even too strong, but there are some competent people. But, I think right now, a lot of what we're seeing is his own defense ministry is not serving him well.
Yeah.
Botero is a problem. He's not, I don't care how right wing you are, he is not a good manager.
No.
But he is a rebased choice, and I don't think Duque has the power to get rid of him. And so what a time to have your defense ministry adrift, as well as your high command of the armed forces adrift. That's all I have to say about that.
There's too much to say about these things. And we worry, of course, those of us observing or reporting on and living here, we worry about the violence in the countryside, this aggression towards assassination of social and community leaders. We know that some are affiliated to groups and others are not, but we're in a country that supposedly was, trying to turn the page on these dark years. But it's increasing. These are targeted assassinations.
Yes.
And I don't know how we resolve this. I don't know how the government, the killing of the candidate in Cauca, it was just awful. These things are, but these are.
And that was done in a way that really sent a message.
Yeah.
It's
like every 2 days. Now,
right.
There's an assassination. We know who's killing, but who is behind you know, who's sending the orders?
Look, if you, exactly. I mean, who are the masterminds? And if you really gave a crap about this problem, you wouldn't have to put, I mean, lawyers aren't that expensive. Investigators, I mean, it costs some money, but it costs, for the cost of 1.5 Black Hawk helicopters, you could have a very strong unit in the Fiscalía, well guarded with, you know, people with, you know, their backgrounds thoroughly checked, who would be investigating even just a handful of these most emblematic cases and getting to the masterminds. When you get to the masterminds, you know, yeah, sometimes it'll just be Klein de Goffel or ELN, some, but often it'll be, well, who hired the Klein de Goffel?
Yeah.
And you'll be getting right up, you know, to people who are very powerful in local politics, people who are probably, whose political groups are probably going to do quite well in the municipal and local elections. And you'll have to find them and name them and punish at least a few of them in emblematic cases. If you were to increase the probability of punishment for masterminding some of these killings, you'd see a sharp drop. Look, I mean, as soon as they started, after the Soacha killings in 2008, as soon as they started punishing and firing some responsible officers for false positives, extrajudicial executions went down to the low double digits and have stayed there. You just have to increase the probability of punishment. And right now, I think if you're a mastermind, if you're a trigger puller, yeah, maybe. If you're the guy in the motorcycle, maybe you're in some danger of being discovered and sent to prison. But if you are somebody who, you know, sat at your in your steak restaurant and you know, made your deal to have, you know, these nuisances taken out, you probably don't have much to worry about still, because there has not been enough of an effort. I know there is an effort in the Fiscalía, and they always say how many cases they've clarified, whatever that means, but quite often that does not mean the masterminds.
Well, yeah, you know, a clarification to me doesn't mean that someone's been brought to justice.
That means they have a likely suspect, yeah, probably. Yeah.
Okay, well done. You've got as far, now you've got to jump. You know, mm-hmm. It's a tough time. You know, I think, you know, I first moved here and we're winding down. I first came to Colombia in like 1998 or so.
Wow, okay.
But I moved here full time in 2007. And, you know, 98 when I was on the Pacific Coast. I was working for an NGO.
Wow.
And I traveled up and down from Guapi to Buenaventura by boat. And that, you know, it was pretty hairy at times. You know?
But it was quieter then than it is now in the Pacific. Yeah.
I am in a stage now where I feel that there's a greater aggression around than I have felt before in quite some time. Now, the Uribe years were quite, there was some pretty awful moments as well, but I was kind of at the tail end of one of his.
Yeah, 07 would have been late.
You know, and so his star was waning as well. You know, that his second term he spent trying to get reelected, you know, for a third term. So rather than that.
No, the first term when you had, you know, Fernando Londoño being a minister of both two departments, I mean, that was, yeah, it was different than later on when Santos was his defense minister.
Yeah, I feel now, though, that there's an unease here in Colombia.
I guess there is.
I don't know how else to put it. When I'm talking last week with Stephen Grattan, the foreign correspondent, he says there's something simmering around the country. There's something, because of course he was out in Caucasia and he was out somewhere else, and someone from Venezuela board. I just feel an unease.
Now, are people afraid of a return to the 90s, or is it more like you're going to see an explosion like Santiago or Quito?
I don't know. Are we organized enough for that? Because everything,
right?
Quito was really organized.
Well, I mean, the Constitutional Court just like took away one of Duque's main sources of revenue, right? Which means they're probably going to have to hit consumers with something, you know. And it is usually a raise in rates of something that causes these estallidos sociales to happen. So that could be it.
Could be.
But it could be also just a generalized return to, you know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Criminal,
I mean,
violence.
I don't say that, because you can't on any occasion say that, you know, Colombians are passive. I mean, we've been living in conflict for so many years.
Right.
So they have, you know,
Colombians are definitely not passive.
People have been up in arms, but in a different way to maybe, you know, let's say the last 30 years in Chile or the last whatever. In Ecuador, but there's something, I don't know, but I know, we will get hit in the wallet, will we, how will Colombia react, I don't know.
Yeah, somebody who probably, you know, in Ciudad Bolívar, who already spends one-fifth of their income to come to their work as a domestic in Bogota and suddenly gets an increase, yeah, they're not going to take that.
They're not going to be
lying down.
That's right.
So it could be that, I don't know, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's because I'm not here. I can't tell you the unease as well. It's interesting to hear what you think of that.
I'm just watching at the moment because, okay, this is out after the elections, but we've had student strikes, transport strikes, the FedEx, and then 21st of November is going to be the big nationwide strike.
With
CUT is organizing it. There are about 6 to 7 other unions. This is going to be a big one. This one, the 21st. I've already told my wife, you know, block out your day. Don't go anywhere.
Right.
You know,
don't
because we don't live too far from the Pedagogica. You could smell the tear gas up here.
Wow.
You get the feeling that it's going to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, this bit, a kind of social unrest is going to continue. What it will lead to, I don't know. But
elsewhere, it's led to populist authoritarian leaders doing quite well in the next elections.
Yeah. You don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we could talk for hours, but unfortunately, we can't.
No, that's a shame.
It's a shame because we really could. But it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. I've been talking to Adam Isaacson, who is the Director for Defense Oversight for WOLA. That's the Washington Office in Latin America. Check out the website. It's WOLA at WOLA.org. And, of course, his blog is adamisaacson.com.
When I manage to update it. Yes.
Well, you do. And when it's up there, it's fascinating stuff. So do. And if you are feeling philanthropic, throw some money.
Great.
Throw some money at these entities. I genuinely.
It will be well used.
Of course. Yeah. So thank you so much for agreeing and coming to my home and recording this. And
it's a huge pleasure.
Promise me you'll come on again, perhaps in the future when we've got when we can reflect and say we saw that something was there was unease in Colombia.
That would be excellent if we could do that.
Let's follow up on that.
Hope it's not too soon, but it may be.
Anyway, this has been a great episode. Thank you all for listening. I know that a lot of you actually had asked for Adam Isaacson to be a guest. So it's that we've got him on here is a real coup for us. So this has been episode 297.
That's amazing, too.
297. Yeah, we're 3 away of the Columbia Calling podcast. Thank you again for listening. Of course, check out our partner site, Columbia Reports. Adrian's out there, struggling with the independent press out of Medellin.
Big shout out to Adrian.
Adrian. And throw some money at his Patreon site because independent press needs to continue to tell some of the news out of here, Columbia. So that's me signing off this week from Columbia Calling. Get in touch, Facebook, Twitter, columbiacalling@gmail.com. And thank you very much again for listening.